Good morning, everyone. Sorry for not being able to be there with you in this very interesting session of this conference. And I'm really grateful to Tim and to Cameron, who allowed me to be there in this way. I'm going to share with you some ideas around sustainable intensification and what the term means. By the way, I'm Paolo Titonel. I'm National Coordinator of the Program Natural Resources and Environment of INTA in Argentina, and I'm a former professor of farming systems ecology at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. If we talk about sustainable intensification, we need to talk about sustainability. And sustainability has been one of the most elusive concepts of our age. We all agree that sustainability is a form of intergenerational equity, right? That we can preserve the capacity of future generations to produce as we do today or better. It's what we call a soft target as opposed to a hard target. For example, if we look at the Millennium Development Goals or the Sustainable Development Goals, we're actually talking normally about hard targets. In sustainability, we don't have that. We actually have to operationalize these soft targets into a hard goal. For that, people have been using different approaches. The first one was the idea of dimensions of sustainability from the Brundtland report. And they started talking already about social, environmental, and economic dimensions as a way of operationalizing the concept of sustainability. Another approach to try to operationalize the concept of sustainability has been the idea of using indices. For instance, calculating an index, which is a way of making a semi-quantitative assessment of sustainability, where you can use scores and rankings and compare systems. A bit more developed is the idea of using indicators, which normally stem from general principles like efficiency or resilience or stability. And from there, we choose indicators to represent those system properties and reference values and thresholds to be able to actually assess those indicators. So one of the most influential indicator systems in these days has been the planetary boundaries. The idea that we have a certain number of boundaries, a certain number of thresholds that we should not overpass in order to keep the Earth within a safe operational space. Here we have a representation of that with 9 different principles. And for each of these principles, we could actually come up with a number of indicators. And we know that we are not doing very well. We've been trespassing the limits, the boundaries, in terms of biosphere integrity, especially genetic diversity due to biodiversity loss, but also in terms of biogeochemical flows. We are beyond the capacity of the Earth to actually cope with the flows of nitrogen and phosphorus that we are generating associated with human activities, especially with agriculture. So we could actually start by saying, well, it's hard to define what sustainability is, but at least we can define what unsustainability is, what is not sustainable, right? So any form of agricultural intensification that contributes to trespassing these boundaries or that jeopardizes the ability of future generations to feed themselves can be considered to be unsustainable. If we look at agriculture, especially modern agriculture in the last 50 to 60 years, the agriculture that issued from what we call the Green Revolution, what we see is that in the context in which that Green Revolution took place, we needed to increase production at planetary level. And we did. We did that. We increased production, but we also increased enormously the demands for nutrients and water in agriculture, as well as the use of pesticides. If we take the case of cereals, now to be able to double yield, we had to use 7 times more nitrogen, 3 times more phosphorus, and twice as much irrigation water, as we know from this classic publication from David Tillman. Beyond that, we move from varieties which normally would contribute a lot of carbon to the soil to varieties which have less biomass and contribute less carbon to the soil. We lost 50 petagrams of carbon from the soil surface worldwide. So this is basically associated with the idea of having changed the architecture of our crops. And if we look at the results of that transformation in agriculture, we see that in many parts of the world, this transformation led to increasing yields. In parts of the world where yields did not increase, neither per capita nor per area. That's where we see hunger today, and that's where the Green Revolution did not work for many, many reasons. So this gap in productivity between regions can also be seen in terms of gaps of human welfare between regions. And if we look at the predictions for oil extraction in the future, all predictions seem to say that we're going to get less and less oil, and that in fact we passed our peak oil production already in the year 79. At that moment of peak oil production, we could produce about 6 barrels per person per year. But to feed an average person in the developed world with the type of agriculture we have today, we need 1,500 liters of oil equivalents per person per year, which means 12 barrels, so twice as much as what we could produce during peak oil production. And the consequences of that are many. Now we're scrapping the earth for oil, like in these areas of the tar sands in the north of Canada, and with enormous consequences for the environment. All of that is done in the name of feeding the world. We need to intensify, we need to produce more, because we need to feed the world. Actually, we have, on the one hand, the most productive areas of the world, where we have the highest yields, and we have the places with the lowest productivity and where people are hungry. Some people say, well, look, hunger is just a matter of distribution. In between, there are many other demands for that food, which are perhaps easier to satisfy than the needs of poor people in very remote rural areas. Beyond, when we talk about the problem of food security, it's not just about availability, but also access, stability, and utilization of that food. And this study shows a little bit why that happens. What we see is that the most productive areas of the world, the Pampas in South America, the North America, Europe, China, in all those highly productive areas, the fraction of food that actually enters the food system is very low. It's just 20 to 30% because of all the other demands that I mentioned earlier. When it comes to looking at intensification in particular, we are in the presence of what we call an intensification treadmill. Let me show first a classical example, which is the pesticide treadmill. Basically, we have crops infested with pests. We develop a new pesticide. We start applying it. Then pests die, but also some natural enemies, and then some resistant individuals. They multiply more easily because the natural enemies are not there. And then we have to produce, to apply more pesticides or new pesticides in order to keep this going. Through pesticide application, we favor pests instead of combating them. And the classical work from the last decades shows us a dramatic increase in resistance to pesticides, especially among insects and mice. And the same happens with other technologies, such as BT. For instance, in the case of African bollworm that attacks cotton and damages the fiber, there is a whole discussion about designing refuges using non-BT varieties so that we avoid building up of resistance. But farmers are very reluctant to do that, especially smallholder farmers in Africa or in India. So then we move towards a new technology, which is the idea of mixing in the same seed bag seeds of BT and non-BT cotton to make sure that we have both varieties in the field. But actually, research shows that this favors, again, the building up of resistance, because resistant organisms can actually feed on both plants. So then the next step is to move towards trying to build what we call nowadays pyramids of different types of proteins. We're starting to stock different types of toxins within the plant through different genes, in the hope that this diversity of toxins are going to actually prevent a quick buildup of resistance. And then, again, we see the same problem. This is also overcome. And nowadays, we're discussing about the form of those molecules. We're not talking about toxins anymore, but about prototoxins, and we don't know the consequences of this for the environment. But you see, the same pattern that I was describing before for pesticides is emerging again. We apply a solution, what we think is a solution, is actually a palliative measure, and it's so very easily overcome. Dave Mortensen from Penn State University wrote a very interesting paper some time ago called The Critical Juncture on Weed Management. He shows evidence for exactly the same phenomenon, but then with weed management. In the 90s, we were offered varieties which were what we call the RR varieties, and soybean in particular. Nowadays, we have many other crops. The idea of using RR varieties is that we could use just one single herbicide, glyphosate, and that would reduce the total amount of herbicide used. That was what we were promised. That would replace more toxic herbicides, such as 2,4-D or dicamba. That would simplify and improve weed management, and it would be very unlikely that weeds would develop resistance. That was the idea. Well, after a number of years of using this technology, this package, we actually found out that herbicide use increases resistance in weeds. We have about 27 different species of weed for which we have registered resistance. So nowadays what we do is to try to incorporate other resistant genes to other herbicides, such as 2,4-D and dicamba, which were exactly herbicides that we didn't want to use anymore in the 90s. So the question is, are we really moving forward or backward here? We have this transgene facilitated pesticide treadmill, and in which we have to decide in this critical juncture whether we continue on this treadmill or we just move out of it. So I would say that in terms of describing this sort of phenomenon, rather than talking about the treadmill, we should probably talk about a hamster wheel. Right? Why a hamster wheel? Well, because in a hamster wheel, the only way to stop is to fall out. In Argentina, we're facing a lot of social problems associated with this model of agriculture. It's become a media thing, right? And this is what we call a social tipping point, because it's probably an opportunity for us to actually start doing something different. Maps like this come up in the press, a map from the center of Argentina that shows different districts, and the intensity of the color shows the frequency of the cases of cancer. And so there is a correlation, a positive correlation between the frequency of cancer and the intensity of agriculture, particular pesticide use. Now, as a scientist, I'm not very happy to see these kind of things in the media, in the public media, because we know as scientists that a correlation could be the basis for a hypothesis that we need to investigate further, but a correlation is not enough evidence to say that there is a causality there. This other study actually was done properly before going to the press, and they measured glyphosate in major rivers in the region. When they sampled, they found glyphosate in the water and in the sediments everywhere. Now, when we discuss with people about these issues, we as scientists are really challenged by what we are able to actually communicate in a very concise and summarized way, and in a very amenable way, so that people can understand what the problem really is. Let's take, for instance, the fate of pesticide molecules in the environment. For instance, when we look at degradation time of certain molecules, if we measure degradation times at 20 degrees in the lab, we talk about between 3 and 40 days. But when we measure that in the field, we find between 1 week and 130 days. More than 6 months. So when we communicate with the press or with people, with society, which of these values are we going to use to communicate with them? Sustainable intensification actually means using the most conservative values, right? So in this case, I would use 130 days. Some of the teams at INTA did some very extensive sampling of water in agriculturally intensive areas. And in those samples were done in a participatory manner, involving all kinds of different actors, so that there was no reason to suspect the results later on. In glyphosate, we found in these waterways only 1% of the cases in which we found more than 800 parts per billion, right? And 96% of the cases were, we found less than 300 parts per billion. So is this safe? Is this water safe? Well, it really depends where you are. It really depends which sort of threshold you use. In the US, you would use 700 parts per billion. In Argentina, we use 300 parts per billion, same as in Canada. In Europe, you use 0.01 parts per billion, which means we don't want any pesticides in water. Right? So you see that even these thresholds, which could be sustainability threshold, are actually the result of political action in different contexts. It's not just science that comes into play. After all, this usage of pesticides and herbicides in particular, are we really controlling weeds? Well, this is again from Argentina, and what we see here is a database, it's a public database that anyone can access, where farmers declare the existence of resistance of different species. And what we see is that in most cases, when this, taking the case of amaranthus, but in most cases we see an increase in resistance to herbicides, right? For Lolium, for amaranthus, for Eleocine indica, for Cynodon, and for Rabanus, and for Sorghum alipensis. So in the end, this idea of a treadmill appears again. We're using herbicides, and the only thing we're creating is more problems. We can think about sustainable intensification, and we could start by stating the obvious. Any form of intensification that compromises sustainability cannot be considered to be sustainable intensification. That's very clear. But what is sustainable intensification? Well, what I propose is that sustainable intensification is any form of intensification of agriculture that propends to reducing dependence on non-renewable resources, because they are non-renewable, to reduce the impacts on biodiversity and environments, to adapt and mitigate climate change, to produce food where food is needed, and to reduce waste and increase recycling along the value chain. So to me, these are the five premises that any scheme for sustainable intensification should propend to. Rather than talking about sustainable intensification, I often prefer to talk about ecological intensification, exactly because, you know, the discussion about what sustainable is or not is very subjective. Ecological intensification can be defined as the gradual replacement of non-renewable resources and toxins used in agriculture by ecological processes to increase sustainability. In that way, I propose that ecological intensification is a form of sustainable intensification, or in other terms, that it is sustainable by nature. Well, let's look at some real life examples. A key measure to bring about an ecological intensification of agricultural landscapes is through the what we call generating an ecological infrastructure for the systems to be resilient and to have the necessary resources for natural enemies, for instance, to work in our favor. If we take, for instance, this case of predators, of aphids in this particular case, we see that after pesticide application, most of these predators remain in the crop borders, which are vegetated, as we see in the background pictures. And when we look especially at insectivore birds that are eating agricultural pests, we see a very strong relationship between the quality of the habitats around the fields and the efficiency, so to say, of these birds to actually control pests. So with this information, we can actually start thinking alongside with farmers on how could we bring diversity back to this agricultural landscape in order to have these ecosystem services which are important for agriculture. Here's an example of another farmer. This is a farmer that uses principles of agroecology. And what we see here is that, well, he's producing beef with a certain yield level, and he's producing wheat. This graph shows the yield of wheat that his conventional neighbors obtain, and the green bars correspond to the yield that he gets on his own farm. On average, not the average of 3 years, but the average of many other years, the yields are comparable in both situations. But what is really different here is the production costs. If we look at the 90s, the year 90, well, we see that the conventional management of his neighbors and his own management had apparently the same costs. If we look at 99, then we see much higher costs in terms of conventional management. And nowadays, the cost of conventional management are twice or more than the cost that he has with his agroecological management. When you present these ideas to farmers, farmers are very keen on this, because, especially because of the cost reduction of these alternatives. One of the things that we've done at INTA is to analyze the system that these farmers had and reproduce it in our experimental fields under controlled conditions. So in this particular case, we have a field managed under conventional or current management, and next to it, a field that reproduces the agroecological management that these farmers have. And so we compare, we have already 5 years of data, of comparisons, and we are looking at, of course, yields, but also what happens with soil biology, with many other indicators, energy efficiency, etc. And as you see, this system, what we call agroecological systems, are much more diverse. There are many more crops per season. Here we have an image of a dry year in which on the conventional field, soybean failed, whereas in the agroecological field, we still had sorghum and other things to harvest. This is the sort of diversity we can see in the agroecological fields as compared to the conventional ones. And here we have some indicators of productivity in terms of both grain and beef. And you see that yields are comparable in both cases, as we showed before. But what is interesting is this other sort of set of indicators. What we see here is that within the same period of 4 or 5 years, here we have 11 different species, whereas here we have only 4. Pesticide usage was very different. For instance, in the case of glyphosate, we only use 1 liter per hectare in this case, against 27 liters per hectare over the 4 years, 5 years here. 3 applications against 18 applications. Inoculation, much more often here than here. No use of urea, similar amount of phosphorus, and the use of rye husks as supplement and also as a source of phosphorus. When we look at the yields and the economic results, we see that because the costs are higher and lower, you see agroecological costs are lower, then the margin is higher. And if we look at energy costs, well, we see also advantages in favor of the agroecological management. So we know that those techniques for truly sustainable intensification, an intensification that doesn't make systems dependent on non-renewable resources, are there. Alternatives are there. Now, many of these alternatives, we see them in isolated cases, that we can call them, they're sort of niches, right? So how do we get out of those niches? Well, for that, let me use these ideas that come from transition theories, sustainability theory, in which people look at innovations as belonging to what we call a social technical regime, right? Which is represented by this shape here, and with many things happening there. This social technical regime creates openings once in a while for niche innovations to actually become part of the regime, right? And all of this is actually regulated by a slowly evolving social technical landscape, right? Which relates to food habits and cultural issues, but also technologies, etc. Nowadays, in my opinion, we're in a situation like this, in which we have a very turbulent social technical landscape that creates a lot of opportunity, a lot of feedbacks with these other levels, and a lot of openings for niche innovations. Think about the climate discussions. Think about the new encyclica that the Pope has issued about environmental problems. So there is a lot of signals in the world that are telling us that we are in a very turbulent socio-technical landscape that creates a lot of opportunity for these innovations to become part of the mainstream. So I would say that we are in a very good position nowadays to promote some of these new ideas around ecological intensification. But of course, this doesn't happen on its own. This requires investments in system innovation programs. Nowadays, agricultural research is actually affected or is shaped by the idea of sustainability, but also by two other ideas, the idea of complexity and the idea of uncertainty, especially related to climate uncertainty and price uncertainty. So this takes us to look at our research, look critically at our research from an operational perspective. How do we make sure that our research is sound and solid? From an epistemological perspective, how do we know that we are addressing the right questions and using the right methods to approximate the truth? And also from an ontological perspective, how do we know that what the right questions really are? Well, with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. I hope we can get rid of that hamster wheel through our research in agriculture, and I hope these ideas can contribute to a debate around that. If you're interested in reading more about some of the slides that I presented here, here's the address to my blog. This is the blog where I normally write about these issues. Thank you very much.